This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. A century ago, in December 1922, at the height of the Civil War, poet W.B. Yeats was nominated to the Senate of the newly established Irish Free State. Earlier that year, in January, he had participated in the cultural programme of the Irish Race Congress in Paris. In 1923, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, a major boost to the prestige of a nation undergoing the trauma of civil war. He was to serve 6 years in the Senate. In the 1930s, he briefly flirted with Ona Duffy's Blue Shirts. So how are we to assess Yeats's relationship to the Irish Free State? Now, to discuss this, I'm joined by Lucy Collins, Associate Professor in the School of English, Drama and Film at University College Dublin. Theo Dorgan, poet, writer and member of AS Donna. Dara Gannon, Fulbright Irish Scholar in Georgetown University. Yes, this HedgeGhoul is coming to you from two continents. And finally, Catherine McSharry, Acting Director of the National Library of Ireland. And indeed, this HedgeGhoul is supported by the National Library of Ireland. Now, regular listeners and readers of History Ireland will know that we did a HedgeGhoul on W.B. Yeats back in 2015 to mark the Yeats 150. And we discussed the earlier part of his career and, in particular, of course, his most famous poem, Easter 1916. Theo Dorgan, I just want to go to you then, just for the where Yeats was at, you know, in the period after that. Like, what do we know about his attitudes to the unfolding events thereafter, the War of Independence, the treaty, etc.? Like, where was he living, for example, Theo, in this period?
Well, one of the interesting things about Yeats is he spent his life almost equally between London, Sligo, and Dublin. And there is a notorious, or I think it may be true, I've often wondered if it's apocryphal, that when he got a bullet in the window in Merrion Square, he wanted to move to Holyhead during the when he was a senator. So his fascination with Dublin, specifically with the Dublin he identified with Grattan, Flood, Parnell, that the towering Protestant intellects of what you might call the Home Rule and Proto-Home Rule movement, kept drawing him back here, I think, because it was his capital of Ireland. And I don't think he very rarely, actually, from what I know, ever spoke of Belfast at all. Very rarely. He was, I suppose, obsessed with Dublin as first as the proto-capital of an Ireland he could never actually quantify, and then as the de facto capital of the Free State, de facto and de jure, as it happens. So he loved his Dublin, but he came to love it as the seat of power. And I think that's why he, you know, in a sense, he saw the Free State Dáil as the restoration of Grattan's Parliament. And so he was a model for accepting the invitation to join the Senate. I don't think he actually thought through the politics of it. It gave him a forum and a niche in the political apparatus.
How much, you know, of the War of Independence did he actually witness? And I think, you know, like, particularly in his trips back to Sligo.
Well, I think Sligo and the West was more as a direct experience, as we see in 1919, and as we also see in Meditations in Time of Civil War. I think he saw more of the Civil War in the West. 1919, right, it references directly a particular atrocity carried out by the Black and Tans or the Auxiliaries, I'm not clear which. The Civil War, Meditations in Time of Civil War, I think was a more distanced contact, not least because the senators were offered a certain degree of protection by the army and the security apparatus of the new Free State. So I don't think he ever picked up a gun in his life. I don't know that he particularly understood what war meant. He seemed shocked in the aftermath of the First World War that there was a new murderousness abroad. After that Holocaust of the poor, to suddenly notice that there's an air of murderousness about, seems to me to suggest a certain dim-wittedness in that regard.
I'll tell you, Theo, could you give us a bit of 1999 there, just so listeners, you know,
well, I suppose, not enough poem, but I mean, I think lines 25 to 32, 1, 2, 3, 4, fourth verse. Now days are dragon ridden. The nightmare rides upon sleep. A drunken soldiery can leave the mother murdered at her door to crawl in her own blood and go scot-free. The night can sweat with terror as before we pieced our thoughts into philosophy and planned to bring the world under a rule who are but weasels fighting in a hole.
Now, that would suggest to me, Theo, whatever bit of understanding of it, he's not detached from it. But listen, can I just leave that for a moment, Theo? I want to go on to Lucy, right, and just talk a little about his private life, which, of course, is never far from his poetry. So, Lucy, he married in 1917, right? And, you know, it's a fairly stable, happy marriage by all accounts, despite his extramarital affairs. Let's not dwell on that, right? I get the impression then that is there kind of a personal tranquility here, like, you know, which contrasts with the turmoil in the public sphere, if you like.
Yes, well, there is. But in a sense, that tranquility is quite hard won, because the period around 1916 and 17 were very turbulent in Yeats's private life. So we know, obviously, of his long attachment and love for Maud Gonne, that went unrequited, effectively unrequited. But around the time of 1916, he was particularly disturbed about the fact that he was in his early 50s. He was unmated. He didn't have a stable home. So he was very much adrift. And I think what Theo has sketched out in terms of his movement between, you know, Dublin, London, France as well, and Sligo shows that kind of adriftness that we find in Yeats's private life at the time. But he was at this point drawing close to Georgie Hydeleese, the woman he would marry. But of course, in 1916, when Major John MacBride was executed, that changed Maud Gonne's marital status. And so Yeats left Dublin, went to France, where Maud was living with her daughter Iseult. And he proposed again to Maud, and she turned him down. And then he proposed to his daughter, to her daughter, Iseult, and who also turned him down. But he was very close to Iseult in a way, almost in a kind of fatherly way, I think, at that point. So his emotional life was really tangled at this stage. But he eventually...
It's a bit weird, isn't it?
It's very, very strange, very strange and very disturbing. And I think in Yeats's letters, for example, to Lady Gregory, I think his own disturbance, you know, his emotional disturbance, he described himself as being in a whirlpool, which is an interesting description, you know, that sense that he was really being overwhelmed by these emotions comes through, I think, very strongly. But eventually he did make up his mind. He proposed to George, who accepted him, and he married. But that turbulence kind of, in a sense, followed him into his marriage in the way that in those early weeks and months of marriage, he was very uncertain about the decision he had made. And George seems to have been aware of that uncertainty. And it was only really when she began this process of automatic writing, so that is this contact with the spirit world, which they formed together. They were both involved in the Golden Dawn. That's how they met. So they were accustomed to those practices. But this was the first time that Yeats had really engaged with it in a very personal, kind of intimate sense. And that really transformed both his private life in stabilizing his marriage, in strengthening the bond to his wife. But also it transformed his poetry too. It created a much larger, kind of ambitious poetic. He began writing a vision, and so many of the images and patterns of his poetry from that point onwards would be derived from that spirit connection. So at that point, I think we can see him emerging from this turbulent period personally into this period of stability and ambition, just at the point where, of course, the country was entering a deeper time of difficulty and challenge. So yes, I think those the private and the public in that way are entwined, but oppositional almost, we might see in that phase.
Okay, now, before we move on to talk about his relationship with the newly established Irish Free State, Dara, I want to bring you in here to talk about his relationship with what, and we've discussed this several times in Hedge Schools, is the counter state, you know, the underground state as it emerged. And it seems to me one of the great manifestations of this counter state, which of course was soon to be sundered by the Civil War, was the Irish Race Congress in January 1922, in which Yeats was involved. Just maybe just recap, I know we had a Hedge School in this previously, maybe just recap very briefly what that was and what Yeats's role was in it.
Yes, I think this is a really interesting moment in time, both for the Irish state, as you've mentioned, in terms of marking that transition from the War of Independence into Civil War, but it's also an episode in Yeats's life and career, which I think speaks to where he is at that point in time, as Lucy and Theo have both mentioned, this kind of moment of transition in both his personal and public life, but also perhaps presages his later career in terms of the Irish Free State. And so the episode that I refer to, of course, is the Irish Race Congress held in Paris between the 21st and 28th of January 1922, which saw 100 delegates from 22 countries, including Ireland, arrive in the Fifth Arrondissement of Paris, a beautiful setting, of course, very luxurious, to ostensibly discuss the future of Irish independence. Originally, it was proposed well back in the spring of 1921 as this great gathering of the Irish diaspora to offset the influence of the British Empire at the height of the War of Independence. Post-treaty, however, it becomes really somewhat of a great exhibition of Irish nationalism. And Yeats is really at the centre of that. In fact, both Yeatses are at the centre of that. So both W.B. Yeats and Jack B. Yeats are formally invited to this gathering in Paris as experts on Irish art, music, language, resources, commerce, and athletics. So they do not actually take place in the 7 days of discussions and debates, which, of course, Eamon de Valera, Owen McNeill and others are party to, but rather are kind of the central figures in the evening or evenings gatherings in the soirees, for example. So, for instance, there's a major exhibition of 300 works of art at the Galerie Barbanzage, in which Jack B. Yeats's paintings are displayed. And on the first formal gathering, W.B. Yeats speaks quite beautifully and eloquently on the theme of lyrics and plays of modern Ireland. And Yeats's contribution is really remarkable. It draws comment, for example, from the Irish National Press, the Irish Independent, the Irish Examiner, who all state that Yeats really has captured the mood of Ireland in January 1922. And for his own part, Yeats really offers a very interesting note in terms of perhaps how he sees his role, I think, in a future modern Ireland. He talks about the rebellion of 1916, out of which the present situation having arisen, as being created by, quote, a little group of Irish lyric poets. He really tries to draw attention to the fact that these artists, these poets, these writers were the forerunners, the intellectual basis for the Irish Revolution. So in some regards, I think he's positioning himself as the kind of the inheritor of that politics. And I think it's also quite interesting how Irish nationalists, including someone like De Valera, are using W.B. Yeats at this stage. As was mentioned by Lucy, Yeats is really undergoing a period of transition in terms of his political life. It's really only in 1920 that he formally identifies with the Irish Revolution in terms of his support for those movements. But I think actually the Irish nationalists of the day, in terms of Yeats's participation in the Congress, were trying to use him to position Ireland as this great nation state, as this modern, liberal, intellectual nation state. Quite interestingly, Edward Said later refers to Yeats as a poet of decolonization. And I think that De Valera and W.T. Cosgrave, who of course invites him to be part of the Irish Shannon, are really positioning Yeats as this great poet of decolonization on behalf of the Irish state.
Can I ask Theo, can you come in on that? Do you go along with that? I mean, because it seems to me from the you sent me an essay here in preparation for this, that you seem to think that if he was the poet of decolonization, he wasn't aware of it himself.
I think it's very interesting if you contrast Said's ex post facto take on him with let's say Lenin's take on the 1916 rising. They're coming from two completely, both of them are coming from a completely different modality of analysis. Yeats was a great enthusiast. We should never forget that about him, that he was a great enthusiast. He could be very measured and cautious, but he would get swept up with enthusiasms. And I think after the fact, well, after the 1918 election when Sinn Féin swept the boards, and after the vote on the 7th of January 1922, which eventually effectively established an Irish Free State, however lacking in full independence it might have been, I think he saw the restoration of an internal principle of order on the island. You remember, three times he makes a great speech where he invokes Flood and Grattan and Parnell. Interestingly, he never evokes Wolfe Tone. I think he always thought that rule of by the best for the general good was the thing to aim at. I think by the time of the treaty debates, he had firmly identified the best with the nascent free state power. And to that extent, I think he felt vindicated that a more severe critic than me would describe as the comprador class, their representatives, or at least their point of view, had come to the top of the political swirl. I don't think he really was a political analyst in any meaningful way. It's tempting to talk about McDonagh and Plunkett and Pierce as poets, but I'm afraid I don't think they stand up as poets. The Impulse was a good one, but they weren't even on the same in the same ballpark as Yeats was as poets. So that was a bit fanciful of him, I think. But he was right about one thing, is there was no real material base for the success of the War of Independence. It all happened in the realm of ideas. People simply decided they no longer wished to be governed from London, and London accepted that Ireland had gone beyond rule. Now, it was completely asymmetrical in terms of the armed forces available to both sides. So in that kind of realistic world, as opposed to the real world, it was a foregone conclusion if the struggle had carried on. What had happened, I think, was simply the people of Ireland had declared themselves ungovernable, and in the realpolitik of London, trying to hold on to much larger and more valuable components of the empire, like India and Egypt, they just made the pragmatic decision that let them rule themselves, we still own them. Yeats would have understood, for instance, what Michael Collins said during the treaty debates when he said, you think that when you have removed the British army and the British flag from Ireland, that you have Ireland. Until British financial influence is removed from our institutions of manufacture, from our banks and our financial systems, you have not Ireland. So these as poles of analysis, they couldn't be farther apart. But what, oddly enough, I think Yeats's presentation of Ireland as resulting from a lyric impulse answered to the De Valera side in the treaty debates, where they were all prepared, they were prepared to kill off the entire nation, in Mary McSweeney's view, for an idea, a chimerical idea of a republic that nobody had defined. No one had defined what a republic would be.
Theo, you said there that you know, he by the time the treaty very much identified with the free state, the pro-treaty side. Because that brings us on, and I want to go to Catherine for this. This brings us finally at the starting point of this discussion, which is his nomination to the Senate. Now, Catherine, before you talk about that, could you just talk a little bit about the Yeats collection, that marvelous collection that the library has? Because you're going to dip into it for us in this discussion. What does it amount to?
Well, dip into it is exactly right, Tommy. I mean, the Yeats collection at the National Library is probably our preeminent collection across all the 12 million items that we have. And it was donated largely by the family starting in 1939 all the way up to very recent years. So it is certainly the most comprehensive and most remarkable collection of Yeats material held anywhere in the world. And it's kind of runs the gamut from his writer's drafts, his correspondence, his archives, and then quite a few really interesting personal items, objects, his butterfly ring, for example. So it's an astonishingly rich resource, and it's really appropriate, I suppose, that it is at the National Library, because Yeats himself was one of our earliest readers. So that kind of Yeatsian thread runs from the very earliest days when the National Library was based in Leinster House.
What do you have in relation to his Senate nomination?
So there's some really interesting bits and pieces. Perhaps the most immediate thing that conjures the moment is that his card of admittance to the Seanad is in the collection. So I always find those kinds of almost ephemeral pieces incredibly evocative in terms of placing us back in the moment. So Emma Dalton, the clerk, signed the card, wrote Yeats's name on it. It looks actually, when you look at it, like it's misspelled. So it's Y-E-A-T-E-S. And I mean, that's possibly appropriate. Yeats himself was a very bad speller. So perhaps there's something.
As an editor, I sympathize. That's one of those names you'll always get wrong from time to time. With an E, without an E. Yes.
So that little card is part of the collection. And it positions us in that moment where Yeats is deciding, like a number of other writers actually, to perform, in a sense, their allegiance or their endorsement of the state that's coming into being. And there's some fascinating little tidbits around that. George Yeats, his wife, as Lucy has been describing, she wrote a letter, which is in Trinity, actually, to her friend Thomas McGreevy, when she heard that A.E., that George Russell, had decided that he wasn't going to accept the nomination to the Senate. And she says, they think he's going to back out. He hasn't the moral courage of a flea. So I suppose it was probably a comfort to WB to know that his wife thought he had at least a flea's worth of moral courage. And it's not, I suppose it's not an abstract idea. You know, there were elements in terms of deciding that you were going to align yourself with the state, but it was actually also pretty dangerous to be a senator, because at the end of November, the anti-treaty forces, the irregulars, had identified a number of groups associated with the emerging political architecture of the state, including senators, as being legitimate targets. So that the a number of senators had their houses burned down. The Yeats family themselves were shot at in the house on Merrion Square, as Theo had already mentioned. So George Yeats was sitting in that house with Anne on her lap, and the bullet actually hit her, though it didn't actually do her any harm. And so it's very important, I suppose, for us to realise just how volatile the atmosphere was, how dangerous it was to be part of the emergent state, and how well that's captured, I think, in a lot of the poems that Yeats writes around this period through 1922, and particularly Meditations in Time of Civil War.
Now, of course, this was in reaction to the Public Safety Acts, which brought in like summary executions, including of Erskine Childers, you know, for possession of a small pistol that had been given to him by Michael Collins as a wedding present, you know. You know, and this was probably, you know, the ramping up of the Civil War with you know, reprisals on either side. Theo, can I go back to you on this, right, for Yeats's take on the Civil War?
Yeah, I always thought it very interesting that the bullets sort of more or less fell on Georgie. You know, it can't have been a very large caliber any more than the little toy pistol that poor Childers was carrying. I think he was willfully blind to a lot of things. I think you would have imagined that with his Roman sense of honor. He would have, I suspect Yeats would have thought being a senator to place him in a position not unlike that of a senator in Rome before Julius Caesar, when the Senate still had a moral authority. But as to practical politics, I think the most salient aspect of Yeats's politics was his fear of giving power to the poor. You know, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. He didn't actually mean anarchy as classically defined. He very well never even have heard of Prince Kropotkin, for instance. But he feared the mass. He feared the masses. And I think we do well to remember that he had a very European idea of this. Because remember, you'd had an armed workers' uprising in Germany just before this. The Bolshevik Revolution had triumphed over external interference and was embarking on its murderous campaign of establishing the state. I think he saw what was happening in Ireland as having the potential to unleash that kind of mass murderous instinct. And very likely, I think, that he doesn't ever as far as I know, speak directly about this. I think he saw himself joining the Seanad as standing in the vanguard of those who would stand for order. And again, this idea that he never lost of rule by the best, by which he meant, of course, the best informed. He didn't just mean it in the crass modern way of those with the most money. I think he meant people with a sense of history, a sense of obligation, a kind of post-feudal sense of responsibility. How much the actual civil war, how much he understood the actual civil war, I doubt. I doubt very much.
Can I just cut across you there, right? Because mediation is like, it's a very long, complex poem, piece of work, and with a complex kind of structure to it and so on. And it strikes me it's written by somebody who thinks he has some ideas on the Civil War, whether you agree with them or not, or whether, you know...
In Meditations on the Civil War. Meditations on a Civil War. I think the most powerful piece is section 5, The Road at My Door. An affable irregular, a heavily built Falstaffian man comes cracking jokes of civil war as though to die by gunshot were the finest play under the sun. A brown lieutenant and his men, half dressed in national uniform, stand at my door, and I complain of the foul weather, hail and rain, a pear tree broken by the storm. I count those feathered balls of soot the moorhen guides upon the stream to silence the envy in my thought and turn towards my chamber caught in the cold snows of a dream. I mean, this echoes the sort of that moment of detachment in Easter 1916, where he turns away from the awfulness of the actual and takes refuge in the cold snows of a dream. He never really lost that self-centeredness. I don't think he saw himself as a bit player in the national drama. He saw it as the exteriorization, much as De Valera did, of an internal, interminable thought process and of self-regard.
Lucy, do you want to come in on that, right? Because in your notes to me before this, you talk about this concept of the divide itself.
Yeah, I mean, Yeats conceived of the self of the individual and also of the epoch or the phase of history as an ever-changing interaction of opposites, effectively. And this meant that these tensions could be seen as dynamic and productive. So rather than seeking to resolve or unify, there was always that potential for energy to be drawn from that those oppositional states. And the poem that Theo has just read, which is a marvelous poem and a really interesting moment in that sequence, where we have that sense of envy. He uses the word envy when he's thinking about the soldier at his door. And it's interesting that he is at the threshold, you know, when he's having that thought. So yes, as Theo says, he turns back to himself, he turns back inwards. But he does feel that sense of the pull of opposites, you know, the draw of, you know, the active public role and the kind of war hero figure versus the contemplative reflective poet. And while he recognizes that he is the latter of those two, if you like, he does see those elements as always in tension. And I think if we look at Meditations in Time of Civil War as a complete sequence, I mean, the 7 poems, and each has a very different form, each has a very different perspective. And I think that's a very deliberate strategy to offer these different different responses, I suppose, to the concept of civil war. And we can imagine, since Yeats has had this long interest in this interaction of opposites, as I've described, or this sense of self-division, that the sense in which the civil war in many ways it gives this kind of public iteration to something that Yeats has been toying with conceptually in a way. And of course, it's very disturbing because to go back to 1919, the piece that Theo read earlier, that sense that there are moments when Yeats does confront the brutality and the extremity of the violence. So he does recognize the implications, I suppose, of that sense of self-division. So it's very important to him, I think, you know, bearing in mind what Theo was arguing about, perhaps is his partial engagement or understanding of it. I think it's a very resonant moment for him in Ireland's history.
What about then the use of the description of Falstaffian
Well, yes, I mean, certainly he is able to see these figures as, yeah, as almost comical in that sense. But I don't think that really takes away from the doubleness of his emotions around that, the mixed emotions, I suppose, around that encounter. And I suppose, you know, we began this whole discussion with a reference to Easter 1916. And again, there is those mixed feelings, I think, come through very strongly in that poem as well.
Now, whatever about the situation in Ireland, Yeats is a world figure, right? And then later in 1923, he wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. Now, Catherine, I'm assuming there must be a lot of stuff on that in the archives.
Yes, there's a huge amount of material connected with the Nobel Prize, including the telegrams of congratulations that Yeats received, which were came from all over the world and from important people nationally and in his own life. And of course, the National Library actually has the Nobel Medal. So that's one of the great treasures. I think it's amazing to hold a Nobel Medal in your hand. It's a particularly heavy, weighty, it performs its own significance, I suppose, the Nobel Medal.
Catherine, just remind me, when did he actually receive the prize? What time of the year?
And so he went to Stockholm to accept it in December of 23.
So it's well after the end of the Civil War.
Yes, exactly. So he travels over to Stockholm, which is a tricky enough journey, you know, at the time, and he's very determined to go. And one of the interesting things that he says, which I think links back to something that Theo was saying, is he responds to quite a lot of people who congratulate him with what appears to be a sort of self-deprecating position, where he says, I know, writing to Cosgrave, for example, I know that this honour has been given to me less as an individual than as a representative of the literature of Ireland. This is in some measure a part of Europe's welcome to the free state, and I am very happy that it should be so. So you kind of think of that initially as self-deprecating, and then you think, actually, you are saying that you are the embodiment of the Irish nation. And while that is certainly a Yeatsian frame that he's placing around the award, it is actually borne out to a certain degree in the Nobel citation and in the speech that's made at the award ceremony, because the citation says that the Nobel Award is given to Yeats for his always inspired poetry, which it says gives expression to the spirit of a whole nation. And similarly, in the award speech, the reference is made again to the Irish nation having been struggling to find its voice, and that Yeats was the voice of the nation. And so even if you see him sort of stepping away from the idea that it's him as an individual, it's placing him as an individual in a remarkably strong position in terms of the literary tradition of the state.
So I mean, it's, in a sense, it represents Ireland taking her place amongst the nations of the world, right? which it did the following year, of course, when it joined the League of Nations. I mean, so Yeats had this sense of public service then, I take it. I mean, you know, he was a patriot in that sense. I mean, Lucy, would you go along with that?
Yeah, well, I think if we look at the areas that he engages with in his Senate speeches, for example, I mean, some of them are perhaps the expected ones, issues of, you know, arts and culture, the foundation of a theatre, the, you know, idea of the Royal Irish Academy, etc. You know, all of these are perhaps the expected things. But he also does engage, of course, as we know, with divorce, with contraception, with prisons, but also with education. So we see him involving himself not just in the artistic or cultural side, but also in the larger sense of the kind of instruments of the state that he sees as has been mentioned earlier, as for the greater good, and he sees himself having something of a leadership role there. So at the end of 1925, he's appointed to a government committee investigating Irish schools, for example. And this comes through both in his Senate speeches and in articles, but he also speaks to the Irish Literary Society on the subject. So it's a really interesting kind of crossover between these kind of, you know, public concerns and his literary or cultural persona. And it's interesting when he's engaging with education, is that he often emphasizes practical matters. So he's quite concerned with the infrastructure, you know, the school buildings, the classrooms, the facilities, and the need not only for investment, you know, financial investment by the government. And he's very keen that Ireland should step up and, you know, engage in the same level that other European countries do in supporting education. But he also very much emphasizes the idea of expertise, you know, and having expert people involved in leadership in that area. And the interesting crossover, of course, that we find between his poetry and this particular instance is in the poem Among School Children, a very, very well-known, much anthologized, amazing poem in its complexity, actually. But the poem was inspired by this visit to St. Otteran's School in Waterford, which was a school established on Montessori principles. And he visited it as, and I'll just actually read the opening stanza of the poem, which sort of sets this in context. I walked through the long schoolroom questioning. A kind old nun in a white hood replies. The children learn to cipher and to sing, to study reading books and history, to cut and sew, be neat in everything, in the best modern way. The children's eyes, in momentary wonder, stare upon a 60-year-old smiling public man. And the sense in which, you know, he positions himself as this almost kind of an alien figure visiting this classroom, and a figure, a sort of a spectacle in some ways, for the students engaged in their work.
Now, Lucy, I'm visualizing him with the Nobel medal with him, and, you know, showing it around the schools, a bit like the Sam Maguire Cup, right, would be shown in our own time, right? I tell you, I just want to move on back to the Senate, right? And I want to bring Dara in here, because, of course, the Senate that was set up under the original 1922 constitution was a lot different than the Senate we have today, which the electorate in their wisdom voted not to abolish a few years ago. Dara, could you just fill us in on what was the makeup and role of the Senate before we start talking about Yeats's role in it?
Yeah, so the Senate, or Seanad Éireann, was essentially the kind of the idea was to offer a space in which the idea of minorities could find a voice, and I suppose offer a critique of the lower chamber, Dáil Éireann, in terms of policy, in terms of legislation. Now, quite interestingly, and again, you mentioned the modern Seanad Éireann, which can only delay legislation for 90 days. The original constitution allowed for the Senate to delay most bills other than money bills for up to 270 days. So that's about 9 months. So it had a greater degree of legislative power in that respect. And in fact, in 1928, this was extended so that the Senate could delay non-money bills for 20 months. So it really was about empowering groups who otherwise wouldn't be represented in the lower house of Dáil Éireann. So the 22 constitution allowed for a Senate of 60 members to be elected directly. But a significant part of that was that the members could also be elected by the president of the Executive Council, who, of course, was W.T. Cosgrave at the time. And Cosgrave was really very keen to fulfill this promise to Southern Unionists that they would have a voice and would have representation in the Senate. And, of course, W.B. Yeats was seen as the kind of the symbol of that community. But even more broadly, the first 60 members of the first Senate, you had 36 Catholics, 20 Protestants, 3 Quakers, 1 Jew. So it's quite a diverse and eclectic group. And again, it's supposed to represent an alternative forum for political debate, and again, to hold the lower house, Dáil Éireann, to account.
Now, like, how active, you know, was Yeats in the Senate? Do we know, Dara?
Yeah, so as we've just heard, Yeats becomes this quote-unquote smiling public man. But I think, I suppose, his self-characterization in that wonderful poem is a little bit different to the realities, of course, when he sits in the Senate. And I think it's quite interesting that, again, as has been mentioned, he speaks on a whole wide range of issues, from contraceptives to public safety, and of course the major issues which we'll touch upon shortly, divorce and partition. And he spent, on average, it seems, only about 3 hours in the Senate every 2 weeks. But again, it's the diversity of subjects in which he spoke which really marked him as a public statesman. And I think also it's quite interesting that, again, he saw himself as kind of a politician by accident, to use that well-worn aphorism, He often positioned himself as a man of letters, and he would often, in fact, apologize for his, you know, his soliloquies about the Irish arts, poetry, and so on to fellow senators. And I think he felt the degree of discomfort among those who were in the Senate at the time. I mean, he was effectively surrounded by bankers, merchants, manufacturers, professionals, such as lawyers and so on. Very different to the kind of traditional idea of the enlightened public figure I think he had anticipated in Irish public life, which would, you know, come alongside independence. And I think really what's quite interesting as well, as we move into this idea of how he opposed the ideas of Dáil Éireann, is that I think his disappointment as to the kind of public figure which emerged in independent Ireland was presaged by a meeting with Éamon de Valera in the United States in 1920. Both were undertaking tours of the United States in different respects at the time. And he says of de Valera, "I was rather disappointed. He was a living argument rather than a living man. All propaganda, no human life."
Yeah, no, he did have a few things to say about the North, right? I mean, somewhat he says was echoed later by Noel Brown at the time of the mother and child controversy. Theo, what kind of a take did Yeats have on the, you know, the Northern situation? What was his attitude?
Sean McEntee in the Treaty Debates said that in yielding to Yeats, Lloyd George had created a fortress for Orangism in the North. And I think that that's the brute reality of it. I don't think Yeats understood that at all. I think when he thought of the North, when he thought of Protestant, because he thought always of those fit in his mind to rule, I think he saw a kind of an unbroken continuum from the landlords of the South, the landowning gentry of the South, across the border into the North. I don't think he understood where partition would bite most. And it bought in finance and industry on the upper heights of the social structure, but where it really was felt was among the poor, which is, you know, where political impact makes most itself felt. I don't think he understood that at all. But, you know, if you look at if I just go back a moment to the composition of the Seanad, I mean, you'd imagine there were no poor Protestants in Ireland. From Cosgrave's, you know, apparently generous gesture, who did he put in? He put in, you know, elements of what would have been the ascendancy ruling class. And Yeats felt quite comfortable about that. And the great debate on divorce, we against whom you have done this thing are no mean people. He wasn't thinking of the impact on anybody except those who lived as he did in the heights of the superstructure. It's interesting, by the way, to note that among the social evils that having a governor general would bring, Markovitz listed divorce as one of the great social evils that the treaty would bring about. It's kind of interesting when you think about it.
Yeah.
I don't think he understood the North at all, but there was a willful blindness. McEntee was one of the few in the treaty debates who actually tried to make people face the reality of what the concessions to Craig would actually mean. And he understood, as I'm not entirely sure that the Hans Place delegation understood, the consequences of what Lloyd George had promised Craig, you know, in the days before the treaty was signed.
I'm just not at the time here. I just want to move on to Yeats's next intersection, if you like, with the state, and which was around for a long, long time, up until recently anyway, and that was his chairmanship of the coinage committee. Catherine, I presume, again, there's stuff on that in your archive.
There is indeed, and it was an interesting one thinking about that kind of intersection of where art and politics are. The Free State had used, obviously, initially the British currency that remained in circulation, and in 1926 the Coinage Act was passed, and Yeats was very complimentary about that idea because he said that the stamps and the coins of a country were the silent ambassadors of national taste. So it was perhaps appropriate, therefore, that he was invited to be the chairman of the coinage committee. And it was probably in keeping with the nature of the state that there was all kinds of debate and attempts to influence and rouse and fallings out before we actually arrived at the set of coins in 1928.
Now, I know Theo wants to come in here in the coins. Now, just for our younger listeners, right? Now, I'm going to take my life in my hands here and remember what the coins were, right? okay, the biggest one was, first of all, the 10 shillings was a note, a kind of a red note. I remember I backed the right horse in the Grand National when I was a child, and I got a 10 shilling note. I thought I was made for life, you know. So the biggest coin was 2 and 6, a half crown, which is a horse, right? Next one down was 2 shillings or a florin, which was a salmon. Next one down was the shilling, which was a bull. Next one down was the sixpence, which was a greyhound. Then next one down was a 3 pence, which was a hare. It was a hare, not a rabbit, a hare, I think. Then there was the penny, which was a hen or chicken. Then there was a half penny, which was a pig. And then there was a farthing, which I can barely remember as a child, which was a snipe, I think. Did I get that last one right?
A woodcock.
It was a woodcock, is it? A woodcock. Okay, have I got all the... Okay, the last one I was all vague on because it was not in circulation. I'm not that old. but the halfpenny was still in circulation when I was a kid, you know. Anyway, Theo, you want to come in on that because there was some controversy about, you know, farmyard animals, you know, depicting this kind of backward rural society.
Well, what I find very interesting about the coinage, it was very clever, actually, to reference what was the mainstay of our economy at the time, which is agriculture. It's interesting that the only government department Yeats had to battle with and listen to was the Department of Agriculture. You know, there wasn't a Department of the Arts as such. It wasn't Rhine and Taoiseach. It wasn't the Taoiseach's department. It was the Department of Agriculture who kept intervening. You know, I remember Maud Gonne's bitter comment that, you know, an English designer of coins minted in England. She was really quite unruly.
I have it here. I've taken down this quote, Theo.
Yeah.
Designed by an Englishman, minted in England, representative of English values, paid for by the Irish people. Ooh.
And
no bitterness there.
No. Tell us what you really think, Maud. Yeah. But I mean, you know, we didn't have a mint. It had to be done somewhere, you know. And, you know, you could hardly say that representing the land and the landscape and the agriculture of Ireland on your coinage was to show undue deference to the departed colonial power, you know.
It made a good
soundbite.
Catherine, just going back to the material you have, I mean, how hands-on was Yeats in this whole process and picking the coins? And what was he happy with his work?
Yeah, so the committee sent out invitations to artists. They wanted to have an international competition. And that's how they arrived at this Englishman who's so dissatisfied, Maud Gonne. There was artists from all over the world, including some Irish ones. And they judged the competition without, in theory at least, knowing who had produced which designs. And they also were very eager that the designs would all be available publicly so that everybody could accord with their judgment that they had picked the designs that were incomparably superior. They were also, as it happens, much, much cheaper. So Metcalfe's designs were much cheaper than the most expensive ones by the international artists. And I think there's something really interesting about the fact that much of the controversy after the coins appeared, or when it became clear that it was these animals that were going to be used, were about the fact that they hadn't used other symbols. You know, they hadn't used religious symbols. They hadn't used aspects of the symbology of Ireland, whatever that might be. And in some ways, that exact controversy showed how wise they were to choose these kinds of designs, because those designs precisely avoided prioritizing one kind of symbol over another, such that when it came to the point where the coins were finally deaccessioned, you have Seamus Heaney writing a poem about how beloved they were, called A Keen for the Coins.
No, they were beloved. I don't think they've ever been equaled. I mean, we still have the harp on the observer first coin, even of euros, but I don't think any of the coins we've had since come anywhere close to those designs. But listen, guys, I'm just looking at the clock here. I want to move on, I suppose, to the most controversial aspect of Yeats. So this is all a question of his dalliance with the blue shirts and, you know, fascism, if you want to call it that. And I want to go to you, Catherine, on because you've certain letters in the collection. But I want to just go to Dara first on the question, you know, were the blue shirts fascist? Because that's been an ongoing discussion amongst historians. Dara, what's your take on that?
You give me the easy questions, Tommy. I appreciate that.
That's what you're here for.
That is the question of the day, really, in some respects, because, of course, Yeats becomes associated with this movement. So how do we define, or how does history define, the Blue Shirt movement? And there have been different interpretations. I suppose the traditional view articulated by Maurice Manning is that they weren't fascist. They did not obviously extend their activities to the kind of the brutal violence which we see in, on the streets of Italy and Germany, even in the interwar period. Others, again, would argue that they were not fascist because if you look at, for example, the ordinary members of the Blue Shirt movement, they didn't necessarily subscribe to the ideological extremes of fascism, again, as we see in continental Europe. And in that regard, Ona Duffy is the kind of ideological outlier. I would also suggest that they weren't fascist as in the archetypal view, but mostly because, for two reasons, that they did not officially try to seize power when there was a possibility in the 1930s. The famous March on Dublin did not take place, unlike the March on Rome, which Mussolini certainly was instrumental behind. And secondly, even if you look at how fascism is defined historiographically, we see, yes, they are defined by an advent or the advance of kind of national ideas and the idea of protection of economies, national economies. But there was also a deeply transnational aspect to all of this, that fascist movements advocated for supporting each other's ideas, each other's campaigns. And in that regard, I think the Blue Shirt movement in Ireland was really separated from continental Europe. We didn't see, Mussolini's Black Shirt movement, Hitler's Brown Shirt movement, directing support and ideological solidarity to the Blue Shirts. So I think they are, in many ways, identifying with certain aspects of fascism, for example, the conservatism of fascism, certain aspects of its economic profile. But I think they're an outlier as part of the broader continental movement towards fascist extremism.
Okay, well, Catherine, let's bring you in here. Like, what does the man himself have to say about this in these letters? And maybe just explain exactly what we're talking about here. These are letters to Elizabeth Shakespeare.
And so, yes, there's a series of letters from and to Olivia Shakespeare, who was one of Yeats's earliest lovers, and with whom he probably had the most long-term and most comfortable relationship of all the women in his life, maybe apart from Lady Gregory. And they wrote to each other, often kind of gossipy, friendly, interested sort of letters for decades. And there are letters from the summer of 1933, which are very interesting, because one of the reasons I think that there's always been this controversy, discussion about whether the Blue Shirts were fascist, is that so many people at the time described them as such. So Yeats himself, for example, said when he was writing to Olivia in July, he said, "Politics are becoming heroic. A fascist opposition is forming behind the scenes to be ready should some tragic situation develop. I find myself constantly urging the despotic rule of the educated classes as the only end to our trouble."
And that's pretty explicit.
It's pretty explicit, but again, it brings us back to this question of to what extent Yeats was a very sophisticated political analyst, really. You know, his assessment of a movement as fascist probably isn't the last word on it. And the other interesting thing is, and we see it through the letters, but also particularly as you get to the letter that he wrote in September to Olivia Shakespeare, where there has been a tone all along that's somewhat both engaged by and enthusiastically talking about this movement, but also slightly disengaged and slightly amused. So when he gets to September, he describes the various events that had taken place over the summer as our political comedy, Act One, and our political comedy, Act Two. And it only takes up a paragraph of the letter, and the whole rest of the letter is taken up with a slightly racy anecdote about somebody that he'd met in the in the Abbey. So, you know, he definitely has these leanings, and he has these authoritarian leanings, and you can see that there's a pull towards some of the dimensions of fascism. But at the same time, in these letters and in other letters, he's kind of presenting it in a way that harks back to how he had described himself talking about the revolutionary leaders before 1916, where he says in Easter 1916, you know, a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion round the fire at the club. So there's some element of having it both ways, I think.
Okay, actually, Theo, do you want to come in on that? Because like you were talking about earlier about Yeats's kind of this idea of his elitist view of the best, right? And he also had certain authoritarian tendencies. So is there a contradiction here?
I think there is. And it kind of, if you like, this kind of illustrates Yeats's political naivety in some ways, because classical fascism, if you could use the term, was programmatically opposed to intellectuals. And by extension, therefore, would be the antithesis of Yeats's idea of the benign rule of the best educated and the best placed to understand things. So I think he liked the panoply of it. He liked the drama of it. He liked the theatre of it. He can't possibly have had any time for that boor and buffoon, Ono Duffy. I can't see that at all. I can't see them lasting 5 minutes in the same room together. I think he was drawn probably to anything that offered a pole of resistance to the emergence of Fianna Fáil, the reappearance of the party of the men of no property in public affairs and indeed in the Dáil. He was always an authoritarian, but he believed in the essentially benign nature of authority when it was exercised by those whom he considered the best, i.e. people who knew which knife and fork to use when they sat around the dinner table. I think he was a bit of an idiot, to be honest with you. And if you look at him, Yeats betrays himself in those god-awful songs he wrote for O'Duffy's mob. And they're dreadful. They're easily the worst things he ever wrote. And so in that sense, he betrayed himself, or rather he betrayed the lack of sincerity in his welcoming of what he termed to Olivia Shakespeare fascism. You only have to imagine, and Darren makes a very good point about the international nature of fascism, the mutually supportive ethos of fascism. If you imagine if Mosley had somehow succeeded in seizing power in London, I can't see Yeats, or even for that matter, O'Duffy, for all his bluster, making common cause with Mosley.
Yeah, but O'Duffy did make common cause with the international fascist movement later, but I think that's a different discussion. Maybe, Darrow, if you want to just come in briefly on that point.
Yeah, I was just going to, add to what has just been said. And I think the intellectual aspect is very much what marks Yeats apart from others who might have subscribed to fascist ideas or flirted with fascist ideas, you might say. I mean, he states in one letter, which I came across, he says, "I'm convinced that if the Spanish War goes on or if it ceases and O'Duffy's volunteers return heroes, my quote-unquote pagan institutions, the theatre, the academy, will be fighting for their lives against combined Catholic and Gaelic bigotry." So I think in some respects, he sees O'Duffy as he sees him as a fascist, but it's a fascism which is not of Yeats's liking. And I think that's something also which Yeats really subscribes to in this idea of what fascism, or rather what authoritarianism can be. And I know we'll come on to this in a moment, but Kevin O'Higgins, I think, is seen as someone who has the best attributes of the authoritarian leader without perhaps the disinclinations to which Yeats was opposed to. He talks about Kevin O'Higgins as a tall pillar burning before us in the gloom. And yet other Irish political leaders he describes as honest, modern-minded men without intellectual gravitas. So I think Yeats has a certain view of what authoritarianism can and should be, and it's not necessarily to imbue the body politic with all the evils and malevolence of fascism as we know it today.
Lucy, you want to come in on this?
Yeah, I suppose just to say that, to go back to the point I was making earlier about this movement between opposites as being a kind of obsessive focus of Yeats, and just thinking about the way, as he posits, say, in the poem The Second Coming, that I think was mentioned earlier, that idea that, say, that the turbulence and violent disorder of the Civil War period would give rise to this sort of extreme sense of order, which, in the form of an authoritarian government, for example, and that Yeats is sort of okay with that idea, but on the basis that it is an ever dynamic process. So then you move on from that sense of the authoritarian to something else, you know, so that it's not an end in itself, but rather a passage through to other possibilities or other forms. And I think that's what his poetry shows, perhaps, you know, it's while his some of his other remarks show a certain naivety, I think it's the poetry gives us the deeper sense of his thinking, his longer term thinking, I suppose, on that attitude.
Just Theo, I just want to go back to you with a quick one on this, and just very quickly. I mean, would Yeats run the risk of being cancelled in this day and age? I mean, I can recall controversies at the Yeats Summer School way back in the 70s, maybe. Maybe you can remember that, Theo.
I think the defense of Yeats is in what Lucy just said there. His best self is in his poems. And if you just see the gulf between his best poems or even his average poems and the drivel he wrote as marching songs for the Blue Shirts, you can see his heart wasn't in it. Whether he'd be cancelled, Tommy, I think you could be cancelled for drawing breath these days.
I tell you what, I tell you, you just teed things up just for a wrap up here, because it would be unfair to finish on Yeats and his rubbish marching songs for the Blue Shirts. So Lucy, can I go back to you? And this is a poem from close to the end of his life, 1937. If you give us a few stanzas of the Municipal Gallery Revisited.
Yes, certainly. This poem is very interesting. It's a very interesting conclusion to our discussion in a way, because it does show how Yeats always comes back to art. And, you know, art as a form of memorialization and a form of thinking about the past as, you know, in a sense, his essential response. So whatever about these other perhaps incautious remarks, that when he engages in a more considered response to his peers and his precursors, I think we get a sense of the depth of his thinking. So I'll just read out the first three stanzas of the poem. The Municipal Gallery Revisited. Around me, the images of 30 years, an ambush, pilgrims at the waterside, casement upon trial, half hidden by the bars, guarded. Griffith staring in hysterical pride, Kevin O'Higgins' countenance that wears a gentle questioning look that cannot hide a soul incapable of remorse or rest, a revolutionary soldier kneeling to be blessed. An abbot or archbishop with an upraised hand, blessing the tricolour. This is not, I say, the dead Ireland of my youth, but an Ireland the poets have imagined, terrible and gay. Before a woman's portrait, suddenly I stand, beautiful and gentle in her Venetian way. I met her all but 50 years ago, for 20 minutes in some studio. Heart smitten with emotion, I sink down, my heart recovering with covered eyes. Whenever I had looked upon my permanent or impermanent images, Augusta Gregory's son, her sister's son, Hugh Lane, only begetter of all these. Hazel Lavery living and dying, that tale as though some ballad singer had sung it all.
Yes, thanks very much, Lucy. Now, you reminded me of two things. First is that we didn't get around to the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins because Yeats wrote very eloquently about that in Blood and the Moon, which readers could take a look at themselves. The other thing that poem raised with me is that for regular readers of History Ireland, they will recognise nearly all of those paintings because they have appeared in History Ireland, some of them more than once, I have to say, and they may appear again. But listen, guys, I'd just like to thank everybody for our discussion here today. Lucy Collins, Theo Dorgan, Dara Gannon, Catherine McSharry. And just to say that the next History Ireland Head School will be posted in late January. And we will be looking at, we'll be reflecting on the decade of centenary. So the compliments of the season to all our listeners. And I hope you can tune in for that. Thank you very much.